a 25-year-old female snorkeler, and she's an Instagram influencer. She comes running out of the water.
So in Okinawa, we also see the box jellyfish, which also has a very potent venom.
Fortunately, a Japanese tourist offers to pour some hot water from a pot that was being made for some nice green tea.
As far as I know, there is no therapeutic benefit of urine for marine intonations.
Remember, we just had this in service and made this protocol change, and they said, Doc, you don't mean these patients. Like,
yeah, I guess probably have to apologize to all the wilderness medicine training institutions out there, because you're going to have to find a way to fill a little bit more time in your class.
Hey, folks. This is Daryl Macias here. Welcome to the March 2024 Wilderness Medicine Podcast with your co-host, Dr. Fred Bossert. Today, we're going to go to Okinawa and discuss some marine envenomations. Then we're going to circle back and talk about some exciting Wilderness Medical Society clinical practice guidelines. One specifically, the one on spinal cord protection for the 2024 update. So let's go.
Well, everybody, many of you listening in are hopefully enjoying a nice ski season. Here in northern New Mexico and southern Colorado, it seems that the big topic concerns are about the unstable snowpack, avalanches in the backcountry, the usual, but we're going to change it up a bit today. After a nice day of cold temperatures and skiing and working here in Taos, setting bones back into place, my mind has wandered on something a little more warm, a little more tropical, like lush sandy beaches, warm water, jungles, great food, the birthplace of karate. Karate, yes. Nice diving. Place further than Hawaii. Maybe Australia. That place can sound dangerous. I came upon this article in this month's journal about Okinawa. Oh, Okinawa, a marine paradise. But this might be more of a cautionary tale about marine-related emergencies. So, before just blindly going into the water, well, because after all, aren't we all wilderness medical professionals ready to anticipate unforeseen issues? Hopefully, before those issues raise up their ugly heads like a moray eel to bite you. So we're going to discuss the article, Marine Envenomations in Okinawa. We have Scott Huey and Yuki Itani, both doctors from the Naval Hospital in Okinawa, Japan. It's great to have you both here with us.
Well, it's great to be here. Thank you for having us. I'm Dr. Scott Huey. I'm a board-certified anesthesiologist and pain medicine physician here on staff at the Naval Hospital.
I'm Yuki Tani, a Japanese physician and working at Naval Hospital Okinawa.
Excellent. Well, first, if we could start this out, maybe for some of our listeners, they don't have a sense of what Okinawa is geographically. Is it a few large islands, many little islands? And what type of healthcare facilities exist there? And how many hospitals are there? And are those hospitals able to treat these typical marine injuries and envenomations that we're going to talk about? And how well are those pre-hospital providers trained, lifeguards and EMT and paramedics, in marine injuries and envenomations?
Generally speaking, Okinawa has a main big island and 619 smaller islands with only 49 inhabited. It has over 1,500 medical facilities, including 3 critical care centers and 22 secondary institutions for emergency admissions. Usually, emergency room can treat typical marine injuries and envenomations. And annually, over 400 helicopter-assisted medical evacuations are staffed with doctors and nurses for severe remote islands and areas.
Wow, that's pretty interesting. This is Fred here. Yeah, that's pretty impressive. And again, it's interesting to, you know, think about that from perspective of just, you know, the overall size and what you can do. That's more than I would have guessed. This paper is really quite packed with information, and I thought, you know, instead of just categorically going through each of these envenomations and injuries, perhaps we just do like a fun case-based discussion for the listeners. So if you're okay with it, I'll give you this scenario, and then you tell us which envenomation is more likely. So to start off with, a 25-year-old man is walking along a reef with tabbies, which are these neoprene boots that are in fashion at the moment, and experiences this man experiences a sudden, severe, sharp pain to the left foot.
Tabbies do not refer to cats. In this context, it is a Japanese-style split-toed neoprene shoe with adhesive rubber on the bottom. They're very popular in Hawaii, which provides stability and traction while navigating slippery rocks. So, back to the case.
Sure. So, this is, I actually really like this case and sort of the description of it, because this is fairly typical for marine envenomations. So, pretty frequently, people have some injury. They don't see the animal, although it becomes clear pretty quickly that it was some sort of envenomation. And so piecing together sort of what animal it was, what was the nature of the envenomation, by sort of the setting, the physical location, where in the reef, what they were doing, where physically in the body, all of these things contribute understanding, you know, what the diagnosis is and then the approach to treatment. For this case in Okinawa, for example, and sort of why we picked the organisms we did, shore diving is very popular. Certainly boat diving is also popular, but I can walk from my house to a handful of dive sites, which is actually pretty wonderful. And certainly there is an abundance of sea urchin or uni nearby with spines. There's stonefish, there's scorpion fish, and any number of other stinging things. This exact scenario, I think, plays out pretty regularly. And so my sort of general approach and sort of what we describe in the paper is that when you have a patient who has sort of, you want to limit down the number of animals that could be based on the setting. So something that could break through the shoe, and depending on the type of shoe, sort of interesting based on the spine, really large sea urchin could break through some more robust soled shoes, but even like a thin soled shoe, certainly the top three things in my differential there would be a sea urchin, a scorpion fish, or scorpion fish related fish with a dorsal spine, and then a stone fish. And so how I would sort of differentiate that is looking at the patient. When the patient has an initial puncture site and then develops intense pain sort of out of proportion, as we like to say, it leads us to believe that this is not just a direct trauma, but it's trauma plus an envenomation. Stonefish is can give a very potent envenomation, very intense pain, and the affected area will develop pretty significant edema pretty quickly, within 5 to 10 minutes. So what we would recommend is that patients who have this and then start developing, you know, on the foot in this example, if their foot swells up almost immediately, to be thinking this may be some sort of envenomation, and then that may put you down the algorithm to get more robust medical care. Specifically for this, so the urchin tends to not break through wetsuit. Well, it depends on the thickness of the wetsuit, but if you're really stepping on this and this goes fully through a shoe, stonefish are known to do this, which may lead you to believe that this is a stonefish versus a urchin, and then that edema as well. The other thing is usually urchin is pretty self-limited and local reaction. You can have some systemic effects, but generally not. And then if the patient starts developing some other sort of systemic sequelae, it makes you think this may be a stonefish envenomation. The general treatment approach, because we don't always know, we generally have a high level of suspicion if there's something out of the ordinary, and we really recommend patients get to a robust medical facility for really any envenomation as soon as possible. But the common things with these things are, so water safety, if someone's diving, you know, end the dive as soon as practical, as soon as you safely can do it. If they are walking on the reef, get them off the reef. If they're playing in the water, make sure they don't become a secondary drowning victim. If there happen to be life-threatening injuries like hemorrhage, stop the bleed, normal first aid type stuff we think are important. And then if you can wash the site, make sure it's clean, those initial sort of first aid things that are highlighted very frequently in wilderness medicine, I think still apply here.
These initial first aid steps are amenable to the MARCH algorithm, where you move them out of the water, then you take care of the massive hemorrhage first. Then, of course, you proceed with airway and the rest of the algorithm, making sure that the individual is breathing, respirations is the R, and you assist respirations. If there's a suspicion of drowning, then you take care of R. Then afterwards, you move to the circulation, not doing CPR first for drowning. But no, you clear the airway, you do the respirations. Then, after assuring good circulation, take care of hypothermia. That is the essence of the MARCH algorithm.
Specific to this case, when you start developing edema and you think this is an envenomation, if you have access to hot water for hot water immersion, both urchin and stonefish have a heat label toxin. And so you can submerge the affected limb and try to inactivate some of it. Most of the dive boats here in Okinawa will have hot water. It's nice for heating up noodles on the boat. Many of them also have green tea. And so you do need to be careful a little bit about burning the limb. It would be target 45 degrees Celsius. But those are generally available on dive boats. And if you're on land, you can generally access it in a lot of places. So very reasonable to do hot water immersion pretty early after envenomation. Stonefish, because of its sort of level of toxicity, there's sort of critical symptoms, at least in Okinawa, we find to occur, at least in the reported case, about 26% of the time, with sort of a prolonged hospitalization on average of like 8.5 days. And so we do recommend early transport to a medical facility. And if you're at one of the outlying islands, early communication with the EMS services for evacuation back to the main island. And then the other sort of normal things with any marine injury, early antibiotics and debridement. There's a lot of marine bacteria that can be sort of problematic. So that'll be sort of a longer term or later sequelae, and tetanus vaccination. I mean, the normal wound type stuff. For stonefish, there is a vaccine or a antivenin, available in Australia. It's not FDA approved, and it's not generally available in Japan. So here in Okinawa, we generally treat these symptomatically, although it is important to note that in other areas of the world, this is available. And Japan hasn't, the Japanese health department reports sort of the statistics on envenomation, and there's been no antivenin use in the last 5 years.
Oh, is that why they don't have it available, just because of the fact that they just haven't used it?
As far as I know, it's not approved for use. I think like in the United States, I think you can use, like, they have some available that maybe for laboratory testing. Dr. Tani, can you speak on this?
Yes. I think the reason why this antivenom is not approved in Japan is frequency is kind of low compared to the in the mainland. So that's why still like approving process is not completed.
So yeah, the bottom line is definitely symptomatic treatment, warm water below 45 degrees C, and the usual antibiotics, tetanus, and those type of things. And I remember the sea urchin in my foot when I was surfing, and boy, that water helps so much, because those things really hurt, and you're left with, for instance, this is a purple spine sea urchin, so I had the spines inside, but you can't really dig out the spines. It was more of a tattoo that eventually came out.
Oh yeah,
brutal.
Yeah,
that doesn't sound good.
That sounds awful. Memorable though.
It was memorable. It was hypo bueno, but it was a good learning experience. So yeah. Okay. Well, let's go on to this case. I have a 25-year-old female snorkeler, and she's an Instagram influencer. She comes running out of the water. She's saying and screaming, oh, her right leg is painful. It's burning. The sensation is burning. And then she tells you that there are several darker lines running across her leg. She's really upset about that because she has never had stretch marks before, and this is really bothering her. And she's also upset that the ugly lines will not look good with her tan. Her boyfriend, however, is around. He happens to be the chief editor for the well-known journal, the Journal of Irreproducible Results. And he offered generously to pour urine on her leg. Nice warm urine.
Now, what a guy. What a nice guy.
Well, what happened to her? Okay. Yuki and Scott, what happened to her? And what would be the best treatment for this? And should she take the advice of this boyfriend who met her on an online dating site?
Stop laughing. It's already the strike one. Yeah. Oh boy.
So I think the patient probably has Irukandji jellyfish. And Irukandji jellyfish is a tiny jellyfish about like 1 to 2 centimeters and with extremely potent venom. It is located in the waters off the coast of Australia. But the toxin has been helpful for research in they first identified Irukandji syndrome, which is a systemic response following jellyfish envenomation. So in Okinawa, we also see the box jellyfish, which also has a very potent venom and can cause Irukandji syndrome. There are many other jellyfish species in the region that can cause stings as well. Typical symptoms from box jellyfish include the classic rhino rashes this patient has with intense pain. So many jellyfish envenomations are painful but self-limited. Unfortunately, box jellyfish envenomation can result in Irukandji-like syndrome. This can involve abdominal pain, nausea, hypertension, and pulmonary edema and cardiomyopathy. And treatment, usually initial treatment involves water safety. It's not done already. Venom is both heat-reliable and sensitive to vinegar. So vinegar wash and water, warm water immersion can be considered. And so also you can remove nematocytes with an intestinal sweeping motion with a credit card, for example. So you can in advance worsen inflammation with squeezing the cyst. So that should be avoided when attempting to remove them.
So credit card would work. Okay.
Well, fresh water appears to worsen the envenomation. So avoid, it is better to avoid. And salt water doesn't necessarily help, but can be useful to help like rinse nematocytes off. Irukandji syndrome, there is this strong catecholamine release, and much of the treatment is geared towards decreasing the hyperdynamic state. So intravenous magnesium has been used, and hemodynamic monitoring and active medications may be required, like clonidine and nitroglycerin. There is also like Australian antivenom, but not available in the US or Japan.
Interesting. And I would assume that the antivenom has similar reasons why it's not available. But from their, I guess, Japanese version of the FDA approval and potential use.
Australia sees a fair amount of box jellyfish envenomations annually. Much more compared to Japan. I don't know why. I mean, we regularly see box jellyfish here, but it seems to not be as big of an issue in Australia. So I don't know if that plays a role. There theoretically, it's possible that Irukandji jellyfish exist in the waters off Okinawa, but I don't think they've ever actually been reported. I mean, they're kind of nearby, but no, we don't really see Irukandji jellyfish, but box jellyfish are certainly here. Although the amount of significant envenomation seemed pretty limited within Okinawa Prefecture.
Irukandji syndrome. This is a painful and potentially lethal condition caused by the sting and envenomation from multiple jellyfish species. It is a systemic reaction. The catecholamine surge is featured with severe pain, muscle cramping, a hyperdynamic state with tachycardia and hypertension, maybe even, rarely, pulmonary edema and cardiomyopathy and other life-threatening cardiac complications. Most cases are fortunately mild. Some patients have experienced a feeling of impending doom. Symptoms can occur as early as 20 minutes and last for half a day or more. But you want to keep in mind that the clinical features of envenomation occurs after the patient leaves the water 20 minutes after, maybe, so that the patient may be initially unaware that there was a sting. Treatment will consist of removing the patient from the water, applying generous volumes of vinegar to the sting sites, and then pressure immobilization bandages in the case of jellyfish envenomations would be contraindicated. Patients that are significantly symptomatic will go to the hospital where several doses of opiates might be necessary. The cardiorespiratory complications are going to be expectantly managed. There's no anti-venom, unfortunately, for Irukandji syndrome, but Australia has an anti-venom for box jellyfish venom. With Irukandji syndrome, we discuss the use of magnesium, which promotes vasodilatation, as well as clonidine or nitroglycerin.
How about this? How about a 50-year-old fellow is collecting some nice seashells to make a nice necklace for his wife for their wedding anniversary? What a gent. He picks up this beautiful round shell that has a taper on the end, which looks like a cone of some sort. When he did this, he felt a sudden poke after picking up this very innocent, innocuous-looking shell. His right hand is painful yet numb, and the numbness is slowly traveling up his arm. That doesn't sound good. The boyfriend, who offered to pour urine on his girlfriend's leg from our previous scenario, no longer has a girlfriend, but offers to treat this nice gentleman with a cup of urine he wanted to use for his ex-girlfriend, which is now cold, and somehow that makes it worse to me. Fortunately, a Japanese tourist offers to pour some hot water from a pot that was being made for some nice green tea. And we all know green tea cures everything.
Yes.
So what is the best treatment plan for this unfortunate shell collector?
Well, let me first talk about the urine real quickly, since I didn't address
the elephant in the room, the giant cup of urine.
Old
in the
urine.
Room.
Yeah.
old cold urine.
The gelatinous. Old cold urine. As far as I know, there is no therapeutic benefit of urine for marine envenomations. I think we can pretty well say that.
Bite your tongue, Dr. Huey. You're upsetting everybody.
I'm disappointed.
Every wilderness medicine hopeful out there wanted to be able to produce their own cure to envenomation. So, but okay.
You can still drink it.
Yeah. Yeah. I know. It was the urokinase. Anyways, this, you know, in this case, cone snail envenomation seems like a very reasonable case. There are many, many different species of cone snails, and there are a handful of notable ones, three species we talk about in the paper. I'll mention geographer's cone, and I have some suspicions that this may not be totally accurate, but in the literature, it has a fatality rate of 67%. So actually very, very potent envenomation. And my children find these shells on the beach pretty regularly. I see them diving. They're generally more nocturnal. So on night dives, I see them. But they are present. And I think about that sort of every time I see them. If you don't mess with them, they kind of don't mess with you. And they're, you know, they're snails. They don't move very quickly. But cone snail envenomation, the cone snails themselves are very present and perhaps a very real threat. Classic envenomation symptoms involve intense pain. And then swelling at the envenomation site, although that's typical for most of the marine envenomations. Interestingly, for cone snail venom, which is composed of many, many different venoms, but it involves progressive numbness throughout. Like if you're holding it and the proboscis stings you in your hand, progressive numbness going up the arm can radiate throughout the whole body. Of the different effects, the numbness seems to be the most lethal one, which leads to progressive paralysis and then ultimate respiratory failure and death if not treated. We don't have any specific treatment for the cone snail, so largely supportive, but the venom is not sensitive to vinegar and it's not heat labile. So we don't recommend a vinegar wash for this, and we don't recommend hot water immersion. But depending, I mean, if you have a good story for it, rapid transport to a robust medical facility tends to be the big recommendation. And then for a lot of these too, we talk about sort of tourniquets and doing that. Generally not recommended. Although if you can sort of limit venous return, that seems to be better. So not elevating the affected extremity, only having sort of light pressure. People talk about like wrapping your ankle, sort of that level of sort of compression and immobilization of the joint seems to be sort of some of the other more field expeditious type treatments. So that's kind of our quick story of Cohn-Snell. As an aside, as a pain physician, Cohn-Snell is sort of very interesting. And ziconotide is a medication used intrathecally for chronic pain and is derived from Cohn-Snell venom. So particular sort of academic interest of mine. And they do have pretty shells, so I'm impressed when my children find them, just as a sort of an aside.
But it's only intrathecal. You cannot give it like in a trigger point therapy type of situation.
Yeah, unless they have a new indication, I believe it's only for intrathecal use.
Well, I guess I'm going to be looking for those ketamine snails for now. So. Okay. Well, here's our last case. So another inexperienced snorkeler wants to go feed the eels or snake or something. And he keeps giving this creature food from his hand, probably chum, when suddenly the snake or the eel bites him. He comes out of the water with a good amount of bleeding on his hand, and he feels weak in the knees, whatever that means. Then he runs to the bar at the nearby hotel where it's happy hour, so he came at the right time. But the bartender doesn't understand this tourist very well because of a significant language barrier.
Wasabi.
Wasabi.
Yeah, wasabi.
Wasabi.
Wasabi!
The bartender does offer to pour warm water on the wound to wash it off. And then the bartender thinks, maybe we should worry about infection. So he kindly offers to pour some nice warm sake on the wound because sake has alcohol. What are some details we might want to know about the creature that bit him and what treatment or treatments would be needed?
The thing is where the patient bite the creature. So for example, so mollies are not venomous, while sea snakes are, and those treatment is different. So where they live and treatment different. Mollies are typically in the holes and have a very powerful bite. On the other hand, sea snakes are more out in the open. And molly eels primarily cause harm with their wounds by direct tissue trauma. So they can cause deep contaminated wounds and crush tissue. So sea snake generally have a small bite and have a potent neurotoxin, which can cause paralysis via neuromuscular blockage.
So it would be pretty obvious then, I guess. I mean, if I hear what you're saying, the difference between the two, right? I mean, it makes sense when you look at a moray eel's jaws and just mouth in general. So you'd see a big difference in the bite pattern, if nothing else. So if the person for whatever reason had no clue what it was, the victim that is, came to you, you think that it would be fairly obvious based on the bite pattern and what it looks like of what they were bit by.
Yes, it's totally correct. And so whether alcohol is useful for this case or not. So the venom is not particularly heat-labile. So, and warming the region can theoretically increase blood flow and spread. So there is no compelling data for this, but hot water immersion is unlikely to help and more harm the patient.
Generally, alcohol is just not a good idea to put on any wound. At any rate, even if it's nice, warm sake, and it would waste the value of the sake as well. You could drink it. It's probably be a better.
That's what I was thinking.
Right. It'd be better for your pain. Yeah. Than pouring it. That would hurt.
Yeah.
But you know, the other thing is, okay, moray eels, I've seen them. You're absolutely right, Yuki. They live in these holes. They come out, but they don't really attack. But when I've gone diving in the Philippines, I see these sea snakes all the time. And I think to myself, why would I want to swim in waters with sea snakes? I mean, wouldn't they attack you or something like that? Are they aggressive?
So sea snakes, like, kind of fun to swim with.
Huh.
Okay.
Poisonous, but
there
fun.
You go. You've heard it here first, folks. Sea snakes are fun to swim with.
So if I could sort of just elaborate. So yeah, the sea snakes are pretty docile. I mean, we see them all the time. I see way more sea snakes than I see eels. I look forward, like, it's a nice treat when I find eels on dives. But the sea snakes I see all the time, they're air breathing as opposed to the eels, which have gills. And so the sea snakes need to surface for air pretty regularly. And so you see them, they swim up. They are very curious. So they'll swim up and sort of see what you're doing. They can be pretty long. You know, 6-foot sea snakes are not uncommon. They're kind of pretty when you swim by them. They're really docile. I kind of think of them like yellow labs. Like they're kind of just there.
Well, that's another good quotable. That's another really good quotable. Not only are they fun to swim with, they're like yellow labs.
Yeah, one of my coworkers was surfing here, and I'm a little dubious of this story. I wasn't there, but he had witnesses to this that he accidentally grabbed one in the surf, and it didn't bite him. And so generally sort of the rule here is just leave him be. I have never seen a sea snake in Venomation. I don't know anyone who, like, friends of friends, I don't know anyone. So it seems very unlikely based on their behavior. So they're very kind of kind. They're nice. They're for the number of sea snakes in the vicinity, I would expect a lot more just based on numbers, but they're almost never an issue.
Well, you have firsthand knowledge, the two of you. I was trying to explain this to my 11-year-old because I'm trying to get him into scuba diving, and he's very interested, but somehow that came up and he was really worried because I explained to him how the envenomation is significant from a sea snake, but that they're real docile, and he didn't believe me. He's like, what kind of that doesn't make any sense to me, Dad, you know, kind of thing. But now I can listen to this podcast. I can see, it's not just me. There's two experts that live in Japan. They'll tell you they're docile. They're like labs, and it's fun to swim with.
Nice. Well, thanks for indulging our audience with these cases. We'll finish off with this. We can talk about the symptoms and treatment with an exposure of the blue ringed octopus and the dreaded fire coil, and then we can stop from there.
Blue ringed octopus, I like watching the YouTube videos of them. We don't see them very regularly here, but we do from time to time. The sort of video, the supplemental video in our paper, was from basically the reef across the street from my house. And so their toxin is tetrodotoxin, so similar to pufferfish or fugu. We were just talking about this morning. I've actually never had fugu living in Japan, but Dr. Itani has, and she says it's delicious, so I'll leave that out there. But tetrodotoxin is primarily a calcium channel blocker, and it leads to neuromuscular blockade, so it can cause paralysis, leading to, amongst other things, respiratory failure and death. And primary treatment for tetrodotoxin is supportive care. So again, transport to sort of a robust medical facility. And then, without being too brief on this, fire coral, well, it is physically on the coral. It's more of a jellyfish type organism. And so it's like on top of the coral, it releases nematocysts just like the jellyfish does, and can cause rash. Usually rash and pain are the primary symptoms, although theoretically it can have more systemic symptoms as well. There, as far as I can tell from the literature, there's not clear data that hot water immersion is actually helpful, just because this is fairly rare. Well, far coral envenomation is common, but it's rarely reported in the literature. So theoretically, just like other jellyfish venoms, that it should be heat labile. So you could certainly consider hot water immersion, but I'll just be clear that there's not much data. And so for both of those things, again, sort of scene safety, removing people from the water, getting to a treatment facility. And then with the fire coral, consider hot water immersion and theoretically vinegar as well. Although limited data on efficacy for both of those.
Oh, there's that boyfriend. He's showing up with his cup.
Cold, gelatinous urine. Wow, it's terrible.
Yeah. Wow. Fortunately for all of these, I've only had brush with, no pun intended, fire coral in my early diving when I was still getting to be expert at neutral buoyancy. and it was not fun. But I think that's like the most innocuous of all these things on the list. So I don't really have a good story other than it, you know, it hurt and I couldn't imagine it being worse than that.
So to wrap things up, well, there isn't much to do about conefish envenomations. There's no anti-venom, and you don't use heat or vinegar. There's some discussion of impeding venous return. Sea snakes, they're going to have a small bite, and they will have a venom, but they tend to be docile creatures. On the other hand, do not feed those moray eels. You could sustain a crush injury type of bite. The bite will be larger. It won't be delicate like that of the sea snake. A blue ring octopus, well, it is a small, cute little thing. And it has these nice, round, iridescent blue rings all over it, which brighten up when they feel threatened. That is a warning for you not to pick that thing up, because envenomation from a bite can result in the liberation of tetrodotoxin, that famous sodium channel blocker found also in those lovely and funny pufferfish and the blue ring octopus. What does tetrodotoxin do? It can cause numbness, paralysis, and cardiopulmonary arrest. It's not a heat labile toxin, and there's no antidote. Treatment is only supportive. Now, there have been case reports demonstrating that hemodialysis might enhance recovery, but the evidence isn't very strong. At any rate, Fred and I, we're grateful to have had this time with Dr. Scott Huey and Yuki Tani from Okinawa.
I have a question. So I recently had a gentleman out in the desert who was riding one of these e-bikes out in the desert, and he fell on his face. And unbeknownst to me, I didn't actually see this happen, but there were two medical providers that were encircling this gentleman when I arrived at the scene. And one of these individuals was asking me, well, he hit his face, he's got blood on his face. And this gentleman, he was talking. He was a little bit inebriated, but he was talking. But this one individual said, we have to immobilize his cervical spine. And when I came upon these subjects, two doctors were accompanying this man. I said, oh, really? Well, how are we going to do that? He said, I don't know, but I am an emergency medicine physician. So I have with me two very interesting people that have written about spine protocols. In other words, the clinical practice guidelines for spinal motion restriction in the WMS. We have Drs. Seth Hawkins and Jason Williams here to discuss some of the vagaries, some of the pros, some of the cons, and some of the misconceptions with regard to, well, gentlemen, should we immobilize the C-spine? Should we put people on a backboard? What is the right thing to do? So introduce yourself so we know your voice.
Hey, this is Seth Collins Hawkins.
Hey, everybody. Jason Williams here.
I think it would be really helpful to take a step back to that question, whether we should do anything at all, and discuss how we make those decisions in wilderness medicine. And really what we try to do now is follow the evidence and evidence-based medicine. And I just want to remind everyone that evidence-based medicine, as originally postulated, has three tripods. So there is evidence and research, which is one important part. There's also the patient population that you're serving, which I think of as sort of an applied anthropology kind of concept. And then there's also the clinical experience that practitioners have. So this is a case where for decades, we followed guidelines that said we had to mobilize the cervical and thoracic spine based on postulated theories about what movement might do to harm them. And it wasn't really evidence-based in any of those particular ways. We have been developing more and more research and evidence that immobilizing the C-spine, meaning having a goal of preventing any movement whatsoever, not only is probably not helpful, but is also harmful. I think in the other spine or the other tripod element of evidence-based medicine, from practical experience, anybody who's been on a spine board or had a rigid cervical collar placed on their neck can immediately feel how it could promote spasming, pain, reduced airway access or protection. So there's that element too. And then there's populations that we know are not well served by immobilizing, like ankylosing spondylitis and people with kyphosis. And there's anatomical variations that mean strapping somebody down to a long spine board or putting them in a rigid cervical collar is not serving them well. I think the really important concept that at this stage in the evolution of protecting spinal cord injuries that I'd like to get out is none of this is religion. Religion is not a element of any of those three tripod points. And one of the things that I get afraid of as we evolve and discuss this further is now there's this hatred of long spine boards and potentially moving forward rigid cervical collars. Long spine boards are great tools for certain extrication purposes if they're not used strictly for immobilization. And I think in all ways, what we're trying to do is follow the evidence. So as Jason and I and the team at the Wilderness Medical Society writes the next iteration of these guidelines or the one after that, what we'll be doing is looking at what the best available literature suggests is helpful, what patient experience teaches us, and what specific populations might be served by this, and making recommendations in that regard. In 10 years, if we find out that, in fact, there are elements where immobilization or reducing motion in certain ways are helpful, then we want the guidelines to reflect that. So I just want to remind everyone, this is not passion. This is not religion. This is not bad and good things. This is us doing our best to look at what the evidence is telling us. And so just to recap where we started with Daryl, in that case of the person who kind of went down, the best scientific evidence, the best patient experience, and the best understanding of the populations that we're serving in the wilderness suggests that putting on tools with the goal of immobilizing the C-spine or the thoracic spine is probably not helpful, is likely harmful. And so now we're trying to come up with ways that we can better serve that population. And currently, the most attractive approach seems to be spinal motion restriction. But in one of our recent iterations of these guidelines, we switched the title of the guidelines themselves away from spinal immobilization and into the concept of spinal cord protection, reminding everybody that what we're actually doing is not a technique. It's a goal-oriented practice to protect the spinal cord in case of potential injury. So just like with a broken arm, you might have multiple ways that you would approach that situation based on the injury. We may have multiple ways that we can approach this problem. And what we really want our guidelines and our practice to do is approach that goal of how do we protect the spinal cord rather than privilege any one procedure as somehow religiously important.
Wait a minute, Jason. Let me ask you both this. This is craziness, isn't it? Because when we immobilize the C-spine, aren't we absolutely sure that there's not going to be any spinal cord injury? We want to immobilize. There must be no movement. What do you say to that?
Yeah, it's an interesting point. What I'm seeing kind of right now in the wilderness medicine community, kind of from the outside looking in, is really two camps of people. And one camp is saying, well, why are we still talking about this? We understand this. We've been looking at a lot of different research papers about this over the past decade or so. And the other camp is saying, well, maybe we should really be talking about this and keep updating our knowledge and these practice guidelines. And I think we have to meet somewhere in the middle. When we're talking specifically about, you know, what to do in these cases, I think looking at the evidence and taking a hard look at really what could potentially cause harm to our patients is really key.
Okay, so we talk about these harms. I mean, really practically, Seth, you've talked about the potential harms, ankylosing spondylitis, but what if somebody is otherwise healthy? I mean, what downside could there be to just putting somebody on a backboard, just saying, settle down, we'll strap you in?
Yeah, so these guidelines that are publishing in 2024 reiterate conclusions made in the prior guideline generation as well, addressing the philosophical or the strategic concept that, like you proposed, if you immobilize something which is injured, how could that ever be harmful? And can't that be helpful in every case? And what we found is that particularly with the spinal cord being in the torso and up the axis to the head, the only way we can really immobilize that, in other words, if we were to do studies where we put leads on people and did motion sensors and saw, you know, really strict scientific studies of how much they move. If our goal is zero movement and we strap somebody to a longboard so tightly that they literally can't move their torso, what they're also not moving necessarily is their chest, if the materials are strapped around the chest. So clearly, airway and breathing and, you know, respiratory status kind of trumps any possible cervical spine injury that they might have. And we definitely don't want to have any deaths from somebody who has trouble adequately breathing because they've been so successfully immobilized, especially if there's no evidence that that's particularly going to make a difference versus somebody who's having some physiological movement. In the same way with the neck, if we were to come up with a tool, which is maybe like a halo or like drilling in, you know, like neurosurgeons do, like something that would absolutely prevent the neck from moving whatsoever, we could succeed in that. But what we might compromise is the airway, or in particular with a rigid cervical collar, which is a poor tool, in fact, to immobilize. If we look at it, it doesn't really immobilize that well. But to the extent that it does, what it does is it eliminates the normal lordosis of the spine. So if you were to put somebody through, and you've probably many people in this podcast listening community have seen this, if you put somebody through imaging and they have a rigid cervical collar on that's not able to be seen by the radiologist, they will read the film as either neck spasm or a collar in place.
Yeah.
Those are identical. And we don't think that that's a good thing if truly our enemy in trauma is inflammation and spasm. And the danger here, I think, is that if we privilege immobilization above all else, the side effect that we generate is spasming and inflammation, which in trauma may result in some of these downstream bad outcomes that we see. So we want to counterbalance that. Is the cost of those side effects worth the benefit? And what we find is if we permit physiological movement that's non-painful for a conscious patient, we don't generate spasming, we don't generate inflammation, but it doesn't appear that we have any consequences to neurological deficits down the road. So this is a case where we don't want the medicine to be worse than the condition itself.
When I think about this and looking at all of the papers that we sifted through for this and talking to people out in the community, I think what's really interesting is that we still cannot identify a single case where there has been neurological deterioration in an out-of-hospital environment.
Really? Like, how many cases have you been looking at?
The literature.
So thousands and thousands?
So this is how, you know, so medical science works, like, you know, through two pathways. One would be case study, or one would be scientific studies. So what we really wanted was in the 70s and the 80s, when this started becoming big, we wanted to have Monday, Wednesday, Friday, you put people in rigid cervical collars and backboards, and Tuesday, Thursday, Saturday, you don't. And you compare the two populations, controlling for as many variables as possible. That's the way, you know, clinical science ideally works. And that never happened and never in theory could make it through an IRB board in the last decade. And now suddenly we've moved so far ahead that we aren't running that study because we're moving away from these tools anyway. The other is case reports. And we just can't find in reviewing the literature the case report, which I learned as an EMT student in the early 1990s, that you pull up to a ravine because grandma rolled off the bridge, and you go over to the edge and you say, "Are you okay?" And she looks up to say she's fine and falls down dead because she's pithed her spinal cord from full extension, which that case I think has been taught in wilderness medicine programs and in EMS programs for decades. But interestingly, we just can't find that case, whereas we do find lots and lots of cases of people who are managed with selective motion restriction or with physiological movement being allowed without pain, and they do just fine.
And in addition to doing just fine, they can often self-extricate in wilderness environments just fine. Hiking down trails, you know, potentially rappelling off cliff faces, it seems that normal physiological movement is okay.
So they won't, their heads won't just fall off or something like that. Is there some sort of a means or a way that a person can self-splint?
I absolutely think so. And that's usually generated by painful stimuli. So if somebody, we're working with someone and we just say, and they're conscious, and we say, please don't move your neck or your back in any way that hurts, you can get out of your vehicle in the front country, you can move away from this cliff face in the back country. It's commonsensical. It would be true if somebody had a broken arm, you know, they could self-split that. And I think one of the really important things Jason's bringing up that I'd love to plus one and emphasize is in our operational environment, it becomes particularly important that we allow people to be self-efficacious because a carryout has so much more consequence than somebody assisting with their own evacuation. And so really, I think in these guidelines that we came up, that we developed in the 2024 iteration, and speaking to this question of what can people do and how can people be managed, I think the biggest change that we made was reinserting an algorithm. And mm-hmm. in the last iteration, we took away the algorithm because we felt so confident that really we could treat these people like other people. And it was just commonsensical that they should not do anything which was painful. And if they were unconscious, which we haven't really talked about yet, you would just be doing soft splinting to prevent non-physiological movement without the goal of immobilization, just with the goal of no radical motion. And people want algorithms.
Yeah, they really do.
You have an algorithm right here. What is this about, Jason?
Yeah, we brought back the algorithm, and I'm excited we did this because after the 2019 paper, there were really a lot of questions on how exactly people should go about looking at spinal motion restriction and in what group people should kind of categorize these patients. And so we've brought it back, and really we decided to make it as simplistic as possible and have built a couple of categories. So blunt trauma with mechanisms suspicious for spine trauma that leads you through a couple of different pathways of either no spinal protection needed or considering spinal protection interventions. And under that category specifically, let's say we do have somebody who maybe has some deficits or some pain, we can then put them into a category of where we are protecting the spine. And we can do that through a lot of different mechanisms. Maybe this person also has some lower extremity trauma where they're going to be carried out anyway. Well, then that's simple. You simply restrict motion of the spine and do that through means like soft padding or things like vacuum mattresses while you extricate these patients. Or if they are ambulatory, you can then consider actually moving these patients on their own volition. Of course, if they're not intoxicated or altered in any means, but that people in the wilderness environment or in the mountains can absolutely move on their own accord out of these environments. But we have to be intuitive about it. We have to do things like take their backpacks from them, let them hike on their own in terrain that isn't challenging or specifically dangerous, where they could have a secondary fall and occur secondary trauma. That would, of course, be a negative outcome.
And I think it's helpful for people to recognize when they do look at this algorithm that Jason just used more words to describe it than are really in it. We recognize that algorithmic teaching is important in our environment, especially at the first aid level. And this is a very loaded topic where there's a lot of passion around it because people have been trained in a very particular way for a long time with a lot of passion behind that training. Like, we were told that if somebody wasn't sitting there on the head holding the C-spine in place, that somebody might die as a result of that action. So rewriting that takes a good deal of work. I think that's the other benefit of the algorithm, is it just provides people with a blueprint for what it is that we're saying that stepwise. However, one critique I'm anticipating from people looking at this algorithm will be, why do you need an algorithm? Because it's very straightforward. This is a little bit like the, do you have time for this project algorithm, where all roads lead back to that you don't have time. The steps that are here are not going to surprise anyone. Penetrating trauma for a long time, I mean, this is decades we've known, penetrating trauma does not indicate immobilization and people do poorly with it. And we've known that, you know, back before even this was a debate. The blunt trauma is really what we've always been talking about. And basically what you'll see as you review this algorithm is all that we're doing is saying, if there's evidence of blunt trauma, or the patient is to the cervical spine or thoracic spine, or the patient's altered in some way that would prevent that from being adequately addressed. And this is very, you know, reminiscent of Canadian C-spine rules and Nexus. And everyone will recognize these criteria. The pathway that feeds to is simply reducing motion and not immobilization. But that's not, at this point, is not radical. It's just where people fall on that spectrum. So people who see the algorithm don't think that it's like going to blow your mind. This is going to just formulaically lay out this argument. And I think really, to me, normalizing this with other broken bones is helpful, because other broken bones can have neurological deficits as well. So if you break your humerus or you break your femur and we're managing in the field, you could build a pathway that would tell you when to reduce motion for that leg. Does it hurt? Yes. Splint it and don't move it. It's just the splinting that we're doing right now in this category is not intended to be immobilizing completely. It's intended to reduce motion, partly because the torso and the neck are so critical for other actions like breathing and not getting bed sores and potentially self-extricating, that we don't want to unnecessarily promote this immobilization. So algorithmically, immobilization is out. In the guidelines, immobilization is out. Currently, spinal motion restriction and commonsensical reduction of pain are the pathways we think are most helpful. But again, this is all based on science and experience. So as this evolves, we continue to look at the best way to take care of patients who may have spinal cord injuries.
I've been doing something recently with the classes that I teach, and maybe you all can do it at home, but I have people close their eyes and I have them visualize a whiteboard. And on that whiteboard, somebody has written in very red dry erase marker, spinal immobilization, and I have them in their minds walk up to the whiteboard with another marker and they cross out immobilization and underneath it they write protection. Because I'm really trying to ingrain in people's minds that our goal is not to immobilize. If anything, we know out of all of this that that's the one thing that is going to harm these people. And we really are just trying to protect them from further harm.
And in the further harm concept, one population I really want to emphasize is people who are known. So we're talking a lot about potential spinal cord injury.
Okay.
And what we know is that, you know, over 98% of people who showed up at emergency departments who are spinal immobilized didn't even have an injury in the first place. And that's sort of evidence-based. So we talk a lot about potential. We accepted back in the day that we would immobilize 98 or 99 people for that one person who might actually have the injury. To put my money where my mouth is, we published one case in Accidents in North American Climbing of a climber who took a really, really tall fall and met all the criteria for spinal immobilization at Psycho Rock. And you can look this up. And we did not immobilize him, which was notable because he was in the water. So this would have been a very, very complex operation in West Virginia when the local EMS system was non-operational due to flooding. So we would have had to fly him out. So much more complicated operation to spinal immobilize, meet every criteria for concern. But the other population that I think we need to remember are people who have neurological deficits. So there are people who met every criteria, but you still don't know. But then there's like the person who can't move their legs. And so I was the first medical director in North Carolina to discontinue long spine boards in my system. And I was scared. That was 2016. Yeah. I thought for sure, like, the lawyers would be calling me. I have an interstate that goes through my county. I thought orthopedists would be, you know, pulling over the scene and saying, what are you doing? And they'd be like your physicians with a bike wreck. So the first case that I came up to as a responding physician, the patient could move their legs. And I was thinking, game on. Like, here's, you know, the proof is in the pudding of what we do. And my crew started to immobilize the patient. And I said, you remember we just had this in service, we made this protocol change. And they said, doc, you don't mean these patients. Like, this guy's, we know that he's got a spinal cord injury. So I think this is really important for people to remember that it's not just that we're trying to prevent further injury, but that in somebody who has a spinal cord injury, those are precisely the population that we really don't want to allow there to be inflammation or spasm. Because if we were talking about earlier, not ankylosing spondylitis or one of these populations, but somebody who's healthy, you could put a healthy person who's been traumatized, but their back is fine on a long spine board. You'd be worried about pressure sores or breathing, but you wouldn't necessarily be hurting their spine. But if you take somebody with a spinal cord injury or a fractured back or a broken neck, and you strap them to a long spine board in a wilderness operation, and you, for 8 hours, you know, carry them out, their neurological deficits could do much worse because of the inflammation and spasming of an existing injury. So in my mind, in fact, the more injured somebody is neurologically, the less interested I am in immobilizing them, because the more I think it's actually a population that we can cause harm from. But that's important to say, because that's a population people might say, oh, well, we're not, clearly you're not talking about people who we know have neurological deficits. And in fact, that's exactly a population that I would be even more disinclined to immobilize.
Okay, if I'm a wilderness provider, if I'm on a professional mountain rescue team, sure, we're going to have, you know, vacuum splints and whatnot. But a lot of us go out there, maybe we'll have a SAM splint. And we know, and we have taught for years, how to improvise a cervical collar out of a SAM splint. Should we still be doing that? Or is that just passe? That's ridiculous.
Yeah, I guess probably have to apologize to all the wilderness medicine training institutions out there, because you're going to have to find a way to fill a little bit more time in your class, because we all like teaching it. It was a cool trick and kind of fun, but we consider that to be a rigid collar of sorts. And so that accompanies all of the same issues that we could see with a rigid cervical collar.
I think one way to think about it, again, like Jason was saying, is let's just be goal-oriented in this. And what we want to do is protect the spinal cord. And what we think is reducing the motion of the spinal cord is going to be helpful. So if you have something that can remind somebody not to move their neck in painful ways, but still allows for some motion, I think anything in that realm is fair game. And so one thing that I've seen described is taking out the rigidity element of the SAM splint and also taking out, more importantly, the goal of mobilization. So I would say if you have a patient, and as long as you recognize success is not measured by mobilization, mm-hmm. success is measured by patient outcome. And we think patient outcome will be better if they can move their next sum. This is like radically different than we've taught for years. But actually, if we could use Nalgene bottles or a SAM splint or something as a, even though they're rigid, as a barrier on the sides of the head to allow for some physiological movement, but to remind them not to do an exorcist move where their head spins around three times. And in an unconscious patient, that's actually valid. Like we may use something that's rigid on the sides of the head to prevent the head moving completely to, you know, a 90 degree angle to the side. But the important thing, and this is the most important element that I love the whiteboard story that Jason says, because really the most important thing is just erasing the idea of immobilization. Immobilization is not something that we think is going to be helpful in any case, but if you have tools that can prevent somebody's neck from moving in either painful or non-physiological ways, that sounds great. And again, just to kind of de-escalate our whole dialogue on this topic, this is really not much different than other injuries. If you're, you know, putting somebody into a carrying setup and you were going to know that they had a broken leg or you know they had a broken arm, you would probably package that in a way that was designed to try to prevent pain and motion to that without necessarily the goal of utter immobilization. This is really very, very similar. So I think in some ways we're just stepping down. Not that these injuries aren't severe, don't have lifelong consequences sometimes, but we don't want the lifelong consequences to be because we zealously force the neck or the back into a position which is non-physiological based on some non-evidence-based belief system. So rigid cervical collars, I think, are out if they're intended to be rigid and immobilizing, but anything that I think prevents head spinning is not bad.
One recommendation that we made was the use of a soft collar, which is something that you can just go buy at a local pharmacy. And we see rescue teams carrying those now, and they're very simplistic to put on, and it can act as a reminder for the patient to limit physiological movement. And we really see not a lot of side effects or issues with soft collars. They work quite well.
Well, what you have all put out is very informative, and it's very literature-based, which I think a lot of providers maybe listening to this would worry about, oh, what about the lawyers? But I think there's enough compelling evidence to suggest that old-fashioned, rigid cervical collars and the idea of cervical immobilization or C-spine immobilization, number one, there's no such thing as immobilizing somebody. You'd have to put them in a cast of concrete. That's just not going to happen, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls. But also, I think you give the provider a lot of freedom with which to decide for themselves how to effectively treat a patient without doing harm. Do you have any last words before we close out?
No, I was just thinking about Star Wars and what is that, carbonite?
Yeah,
Carbonite.
I think, yeah, the thing I would close with is that what we're here for is the patients. And we really like, you know, this is especially at sort of, to get to your story, sort of the first aid carrying person is very well-meaning and shows up a scene and they have gotten specific training and they know what it is and they want to apply that training. And this spreads out to so many other elements in backcountry medicine, like compressionally CPR and all these sort of things that we teach people for certain applications or in certain eras that then don't cross over. So I think we just need to remember that we're not here to be religious. We're not here to carry a flag for one approach or another. And we're not here to bring our massive, you know, brain power of what we all think that we're so smart about to the field and then not look at the context we're doing. What we're really here for is just to have the patient have the best outcome possible. So these guidelines that we create, they are not standards in the sense that they, you know, legally require somebody to follow what we're saying, but we think this is the best way to have the patient have the best possible outcome from what's coming, what they've been injured with and what their experiences will be in their extrication and field management. And that's, I think, the perspective that we really want to bear in mind is that we're here for the patient to have the best possible outcome. So, again, maybe something comes down the road that patients will allow patients to do better. And nobody wants to prevent that based on rigid adherence. That was a good pun. To some outdated model or to something that we sort of religiously believe. And that's the biggest thing I'd like to kind of de-weaponize in all this, is that to remind everybody that what we're here for is the patient. And we want the patient to have the best outcome possible. And for people with neurological deficits involving the central nervous system, that can be devastating. And we absolutely want to make sure that these patients are given every chance to do well.
Hopefully, Seth and Jason were able to clear the air as far as new C-spine guidelines. We hope you read the clinical practice guidelines in this March edition of the journal. Well, this will do it for this edition of the Wilderness Medicine Podcast, the official podcast of the Wilderness Medical Society. CME credit is available for WMS members for listening to the Journal Club portion of the podcast and filling out the questions. Until then, be safe and drop a line for any questions or ideas.